this crisis does not settle down, if the meltdown starts, we will be in session 24 hours a day, 12 months a year.
Senator Stevens weighs in on the nation's financial crisis. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 19th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, studying humpback whales near Unalaska.
We put the tag on as a dart. It implants with just the antenna showing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Senator Ted Stevens met with Alaska reporters today. He was careful not to talk about his trial that starts in Washington, D.C. on Monday, but he did say he would like to testify if his attorneys allow it. And although he doesn't yet know the full schedule for the trial dates, he expects to be in the state in October.
I'm free to travel, but I must be back in D.C. the day before the court will convene. Now, this is a rule of the District Court of D.C., so I expect to be home several times in October, and I pray to God that we're finished by November.
Stephen says the energy crisis in rural Alaska must be addressed quickly. He says he believes the extra energy payment Alaskans received this year will help carry them through until the state legislature meets in January, but he says he plans to talk to state lawmakers about how to get lower-priced oil to the state's refineries to help Alaskans.
About finding some way consistent with our Constitution to sell oil to refineries in the state, conditioned upon the fact that they'll pass on to the consumer the reduction. And I say that because you take the $1,200 that we each got on our permanent fund dividend, that's taxable. Why should part of our assistance to our people to solve the problem of high costs have to go back to the federal government and taxes? We have to find some way to deliver assistance, and one of the best way would be to reduce our price to the refineries.
Stephen says he believes the state constitution mandates oil must be sold at market value, but he is hopeful a state refinery reduced oil price plan can work constitutionally. He says valid concerns over rural Alaskans flooding into urban centers is something not only Alaska will be dealing with.
I do think that it is something that's going to have to be addressed. As far as the federal government is concerned, I do think it is a national phenomenon that people from the rural areas where the costs are higher are migrating in general to the cities. And I fully expect us to be dealing next year with this.
Stevens also talked about Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's plan to fix the national financial crisis. Stevens says he didn't initially like Paulson's proposal to buy mortgage debt, but he says the market must be stabilized.
The question is, do we prevent our situation from becoming global? And even though I'm against the concept, I think he's fairly well convinced me that the situation has reached the point where you either do something now or wait for something worse, that we have to do something worse later.
Stephen says although he'll be in court in the mornings in the coming weeks, he plans to be in congressional sessions every afternoon, evening, and weekends. He says there has not yet been a single appropriations bill passed, and he predicts the financial situation has the nation on the precipice of a meltdown, and Congress will need to keep working to deal with it immediately after the election. Three witnesses in the Troopergate investigation failed to comply with subpoenas this morning. They were ordered to appear at 10 o'clock at the Anchorage Legislative Conference Room, and a packed room waited more than half an hour before Senator Hollis French came out and read a prepared statement that said what everyone already knew.
Ms. Fry, Mr. Palin, and Mr. Raro, all having been served with subpoenas through their legal counsel, have neither given statements nor appeared today in compliance with their subpoenas.
Those three people are members of Governor Sarah Palin's inner circle. Ivy Fry is her assistant, Randy Raro is her deputy chief of staff, and the third person is her husband, Todd Palin. French said his committee would now report to the full Senate that the three are in contempt. The Senate Judiciary Committee has put Special Investigator Steve Branchflower in charge of finding the facts behind the governor's firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan, who says Palin and her staff were pressuring him to fire a state trooper who was divorced from the governor's sister and in a custody dispute with her. Palin originally said she would cooperate with the investigation, but has changed her position since becoming a vice presidential candidate. French concluded the meeting this morning by announcing that this lack of cooperation will not delay the investigation's outcome.
I have spoken to Mr. Branchflower this morning. He is continuing to gather information and expects to complete his report as planned by October 10th.
The committee will also now send out another round of subpoenas to state employees who last week were expected to cooperate but now are not. A senior attorney in the state law department had assured Branchflower the subpoenas wouldn't be necessary, but then his boss, Attorney General Talis Kohlberg, changed that, and those people have not been interviewed. Now 7 of them will be ordered to appear.
The original unserved subpoenas are still in the hands of Mr. Branchflower. He will begin the process of serving them on the 7 remaining witnesses with a new return date of Friday, September 26th, 2008.
While French refused to take questions, Senator Jean Terrio, a Judiciary Committee member and also the Senate's minority leader, stayed in the room and talked to reporters. He said he thought the reason the 3 witnesses did not appear was because of public statements made earlier by French concerning a quote, October surprise. NovaGold Resources' Rock Creek Gold Mine northwest of Nome is finally up and running after months of delays and cost overruns. KNOM's Paul Korchin has more.
The Vancouver, Canada-based company announced today that the mine has received all final regulatory permission and has begun production. It means Rock Creek now has the green light to start processing ore and depositing inert tailings. It's news that company president and CEO Rick Van Nieuwenhuyse has waited a long time to be able to announce.
Our Nome operations have always been a core part of the company. I mean, the company really started here in Nome. And getting the Nome operations, the Rock Creek project up and running and producing gold has been one of our primary objectives.
Flipping the switch at Rock Creek transforms Nova Gold into an actively producing company. Miners have already been digging and stockpiling ore, with close to 450,000 tons ready, representing about 2 months of mill throughput. Rock Creek's expected to produce about 100,000 ounces of gold a year for more or less a decade. At current prices, Nova anticipates generating $25 to $35 million annually. That money will be welcome, since Van Nieuwenhuyse indicates getting the mine online has cost Nova Gold roughly twice as much as first anticipated. High energy prices are partly to blame, but so are other factors.
Wages, availability of people, skilled people to work on these projects, these big construction projects, whether it be here in Alaska or anywhere in the world, is such that there's not enough people. For the previous 20 years, we didn't do a lot of mining, we didn't do a lot of construction. So a huge demand in metals that we haven't seen until just recently here. So it's a good thing for workers to get paid good wages, but it makes it difficult to complete work under budgets.
Rock Creek's a year-round truck-and-shovel open-pit mining operation. It's designed to produce 7,000 tons a day by using gravity, flotation, and CIL recovery. CIL stands for carbon in leach, which uses cyanide to draw out residual gold in the ore. The use of a cyanide vat leaching system at Rock Creek led to a lawsuit by a group of local residents. Nova ultimately won in court, but it further delayed the mine. Then the company got hit this past summer with a regulatory notice of violation for stormwater runoff, forcing it to beef up its protective measures. Despite Rock Creek's big impact on Nome, the prospect is relatively small change compared with NovaGold's 2 central assets, Donlin Creek in southwest Alaska and Galore Creek in southwest British Columbia. Each of those prospects contains tens of millions of ounces in precious metals. Nova's stock plummeted last fall when Galore was mothballed due to much higher than predicted development costs. It came on the heels of Nova's successful rebuff of Barrick Gold Corporation's takeover attempt at around $16 per share. These days, Nova Gold stock is trading at around $6. Even so, Van Nieuwenhuyse claims he has no regrets about staying independent.
No, I mean, I can say that very honestly. You know, do I wish my share price was $16? You're damn right I do. But I think we did what was right at the time. And I think our share price response demonstrated that we did make the right decision. The share price went traded up to $21. Bad news does happen, and when bad news happens, the share price is going to go down. Some things we don't have control over.
But for now, at least, Nova Gold Resources does have control over its first fully operational mine. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, floating the sometimes wild Alsek River.
It has a tendency to go way up and way down in a short amount of time at any time of day.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska. And by BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
Scientists are starting a new research project focusing on humpback whale stocks that summer near Unalaska. It's inspired by the memory of the late Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter. KIAL's Ann Hillman met up with the researchers.
Using a 22-foot inflatable boat, researchers cruised around Unalaska Bay, tagging humpback whales. They're trying to learn how the animals decide when to migrate and what routes they use to go to their winter breeding grounds in Hawaii and near the islands off of Mexico's Baja Peninsula.
So we approach cautiously. We usually aren't doing anything fast. It's usually very slow, just methodically pulling up to animals. And we put the tag on as a dart. It implants with just the antenna showing.
Bruce Mate, the director of the Marine Mammal Institute at Oregon State, is running the research. He says the tag can be tracked by a satellite every time the whale comes up for air. It also disperses antibiotics into the animal to prevent infections. The tags have been used on other species of whale, and the whales don't seem to notice when they're tagged. The researchers are also taking small biopsies of the animals.
It's a small arrow shaft, and it takes a sample about the diameter of a pencil and perhaps an inch long. So we get the skin, which has the genetics information, and we get the blubber, from which we can look at kind of the condition of the animal, as well as look at toxicants.
Human-made chemicals like PCBs and DDT residues tend to build up in the fats of marine mammals before having impacts elsewhere in the ecosystem. Mate says scientists can study the samples to learn about chemical impacts on the environment. He says this small study, which includes only 5 tagged animals, will serve as a test for others.
Project, by the way, is sort of a pilot for trying to understand how you study whales that are in a mixed feeding aggregation, where we know that they go to 2 different places. And we call those different places where animals breed stocks. They're reproductively isolated groups.
The researchers were also accompanied by the late Steve Irwin's family and a film crew. Terry Irwin, the crocodile hunter's widow, funded the new research with money donated in honor of her husband. Their 10-year-old daughter, Bindi, has a TV series and might use the footage to teach other children about humpback whales. Mate says research will continue on the Aleutian humpbacks if his team gets adequate results from the trial run. Current humpback stocks are healthy. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Researchers from the University of Alaska are studying why more young people are leaving fishing-dependent communities and what might make them more likely to stay. The project is meant to shed light on the concerns of older teens and young adults in their early 20s who see few economic opportunities in their hometowns. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The study's called Alaska Coastal Community Youth and the Future. Assistant Professor of Anthropology Marie Lowe is with the university's Institute of Social and Economic Research. Lowe and an associate are interviewing young people from 16 to 24 years old in Kodiak, Sitka, Petersburg, and Craig for the project.
Well, we'd just like to get a description of their lives today, hopes and aspirations for the future.
As part of the basis for her work, Lowe cites a study by the State Department of Labor, which tracked the education and residency of 16,000 high schoolers over the course of 8 years. It found that nearly 40% of them left Alaska by the end of that time. Lowe says her research is aimed at finding out what it will take for the state to be able to retain residents and get young people who have left to return.
Because, you know, we really feel that in the future, there are going to be a lot of jobs here that Alaskans can fill. And so what does the state, first of all, need to do to train young Alaskans to fill those positions instead of looking elsewhere, or to even just attract them to them?
For small coastal communities, Lowe says the problem is related to the decline in entry-level opportunities for young people who want to get started in commercial fishing. Over several decades, state and federal programs like limited entry and individual fishing quotas have restricted the number of people who are allowed to commercial fish. That and other changes have made it very difficult for young people to get started in fishing. As more young people move elsewhere for work, Lowe is concerned about the social cohesion in these small towns.
All of the communities that we've visited, we found that they were really solid, you know, these fishing communities, very solid places, very strong families. People have strong family ties, which, you know, from a social perspective, from an anthropological perspective, that's really important in terms of well-being and success in life, really. And, you know, if you have a lot of young people that are leaving and, you know, those ties are sort of being stretched or broken, you know, I think there are a lot of implications for the future.
Lowe says her project grew out of work she did in the Aleutians, where she studied how communities there were affected by crab rationalization, a controversial program that privatized and limited access to crab fisheries.
What we found in our work in the Aleutians was that, you know, with diminishing opportunities in fisheries, that young people and their parents were starting to look to higher education as an alternative to working in the fishing industry and trying to prepare their kids for a different kind of future than, at least from the parents' perspective, than what they knew. So we've got a lot of first-generation college students out there.
Lowe plans to present the study results to the State Departments of Education and Labor. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
American flags dating back to statehood are going on display across Alaska. The vintage flags were produced in 1959 when Alaska entered the Union as America's 49th state. State Representative John Coghill of North Pole is heading up a project to frame and place the 49 star flags in state offices and public libraries across Alaska. Coghill says a fellow Fairbanks legislator initially found the flags.
Dave Guttenberg came up to me in the Capitol building one day and he said, "Hey, I saw a bunch of 49-star flags down here in this little curio shop down on the main street of Juneau."
Coghill bought all 29 of the 12-by-18-inch flags, which he says the shop had purchased from a cruise ship visitor from California 6 years before. Coghill contacted the man and purchased an additional 36 flags, including some larger models. He says the man came by the flags through a Boy Scout troop that received them as a donation from a retailer decades ago.
They were something that J.C. Penney had made for Alaska's statehood. So they were the genuine deal. And we counted them to make sure there was 49 stars. Not many flags like that around. So this was a real find for us, I think. Just kind of a nice little special surprise for Alaska.
Coghill says he's had the flags framed and a few signed in gold by four surviving statehood pioneers, including his dad. Coghill says the signed editions are headed to the governor's office, the state legislature, Alaska Supreme Court, the State Museum in Juneau, and Signers Hall at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The $6,000 cost of the flag project is being covered by the legislature.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
This week on AK, getting ready for winter. From filling the freezer to stacking up firewood, plus planting trees that will survive the winter. That and more on AK from APRN.
Alaska's parents with limited English now have new Spanish tools to help prepare their young children for school. KSKA's Len Anderson explains.
40% of Alaska's children enter school lacking the skills they need to succeed. And adds Abby Hensley, director of Best Beginnings, children who start behind too often stay behind and frequently drop out during high school. Thursday morning in the children's section of Anchorage's Lusac Library, Hensley stood behind a temporary podium. She displayed a trio of brand new publications.
Today, Best Beginnings is presenting the first in a series of family-friendly booklets in languages other than English. And this first set is in Spanish.
The three booklets are divided according to babies, birth to 18 months, toddlers, 18 to 36 months, and preschoolers 36 to 60 months.
Each booklet describes activities that promote positive brain development in all the ways that brains grow. And the activities are designed for busy parents to do with materials that everybody has readily available in your own home.
Best Beginnings itself is a statewide public-private partnership seeking to combine available resources to prepare children for entering school. In the case of the booklets, a major partner was Alaska Children's Trust within the State Department of Education and Early Childhood Development. The trust contributed the bulk of the $100,000 required for the creation, translation, and publication of the initial 3,500 copies. Best Beginnings has also produced Early Learning Guidelines in English. That publication is available both in print and at its website. While the booklets were primarily designed for parents, Marie Hartz sees another important target group. Hartz is a child adult care home specialist with Anchorage's Department of Health and Human Services. She wants to make certain the booklets get to others besides parents.
8 to 12 hours is very normal child care in the home or in a center, and these books are actually going to be available to homes and centers.
Hart says right now Anchorage has about 50 Spanish-speaking home-based child care operations, plus 5 large centers with some Spanish-speaking staff for Spanish-speaking children.
These books are going to be very important for them to be able to read, communicate, and use the activities to assist parents and child caregivers in caring for children.
Carol Como, Anchorage School Superintendent, agrees. She praised the Spanish booklet's culturally based approach to preparing children for English-speaking schools and using things as simple and important as a song.
I am an absolute believer that if parents sing to their kids, tell stories, that's as good at the beginning, and so their cultural values can come in. So I think these are the kinds of things that if they're in the language they're comfortable with, they're going to see that, oh, I can do that.
Besides Anchorage, other communities initially targeted for distribution of the booklets are Fairbanks, Juneau, Kodiak, and Sitka. Hensley says Spanish was chosen as the first in the series because that's the most dominant primary language spoken in Alaska after English. Next spring, the second group of 3 booklets will appear in Yupik. Like their Spanish predecessor, those booklets too will present activities chosen from the state list of 165 that fit best with the Yupik culture and using materials most apt to be found in the children's homes. This is Len Anderson.
Disaster struck 2 raft trips this summer on the Alsek River, which flows from the Yukon to Alaska. A skilled rafter from Idaho and his son died after getting thrown from their raft in June. A few days earlier, a calving glacier sent a wall of water through another group's campsite. Possessions and boats were scattered, but no one was hurt. About 80 groups float through the remote wilderness along the Alsek each summer, and disasters are extremely rare. But as KTOO's John Ryan reports, the risk is always there.
The sun shines on a small clearing in the aspens and spruce along the Tatshenshini River, near the southwest corner of the Yukon Territory. Outfitters Kate and Stan Bohr of Haines are helping our small group get 2 inflatable rafts ready for 10 days of no turning back travel. From here, the Tatshenshini flows into the Alsek River. The Alsek punches through the world's tallest coastal mountains to enter the Gulf of Alaska. Mostly, the Bohrs are teaching us the meticulous art of securing hundreds of pounds of food and gear onto the rafts.
Especially for the canyon, we want to strap these into place for these boxes to keep them from moving around. And again, we're going to have bags on top of this, too. You can use that blue one there and just feed it.
On each raft, we build a waterproof jigsaw puzzle of dry bags, ammunition cans, coolers, and buckets. Then comes Stan's safety talk on the 140 miles of what he calls extreme wilderness that we're about to travel. Hypothermia, icebergs, capsizes, grizzlies. Until this point, the scariest moment of the trip was wondering whether customs officials would let us enter Canada with a keg of beer from Haines.
And maybe the only other thing is the fluctuating river. It has a tendency to go way up and way down in a short amount of time at any time of day. So make sure you have your boats well tied up.
The midday sky turns dark and fat raindrops start to pelt us. The river is about a foot below flood stage. That's when it becomes an extremely difficult Class 5 rapid. Bohr says he's rapted this river 60 times over the past 30 years, but rarely when the river is this high.
So it is a little deceptive. It is high. It's going to be a flush through there. It's going to be happening really fast.
Bohr warns us that we'll enter a canyon and the worst rapids of the 10-day trip just about a half hour after we start.
Your biggest nemesis are canyon walls, and you'll see as soon as you enter it, it's really sharp rocks. You just really can't hit the walls or you risk putting a hole in your boat. And that changes the whole complexion of the day.
Except when it's flooding, the Tot is not an especially fierce river. It's fabled among river rafters because of its scenery and wildness, not the whitewater thrills. Our party of four Juneau residents and one friend from Seattle sets off. Two of us have rafted the Tot before. Four of us are wearing dry suits, and we've all got life vests on. The river decides not to rise anymore that day, and we manage to make our way through the rapids unscathed. We only bounce Stan's expensive Hypalon raft once off the sharp canyon walls. After the canyon, the Tot flows fast, 10 or 15 miles an hour, but mostly smooth and green. We're able to enjoy the sights and sounds of leaving civilization behind. But there's a hazard downstream hanging over our heads. It's early enough in the summer that the river might still be blocked off by icebergs where it enters Alsek Lake near the end of the trip. Before seeing us off, Stan Bohr had told us it's one of the bigger hazards of the trip.
It happens all the time. People misjudge the lake and where the icebergs are, and they go rowing out amongst the icebergs and occasionally get pinched between them.
We might have to portage the 1,000-pound rafts, possibly over jagged breakup ice, if the lake isn't passable. But we have a week of easy rafting, oversized scenery, and spruce tip ale to enjoy before we have to cross that bridge. And there's a little history to make. At our campsite on Melt Creek, I open up the biggest dry bag I could find on the internet. I pull out a tiny battery-powered amplifier and my Fender Stratocaster guitar. I welcome evidence to prove me wrong, but for now, I'll claim the first electric guitar descent of the Tocantinsinhee River. Near the Yukon-BC border, I'm John Ryan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Paul Korchin in Nome, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and John Ryan on the Alsek River. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The strongest voices in the community, business, and government can be heard each Tuesday on APRN's Talk of Alaska. Get your message out by becoming an APRN program sponsor. Details at 907-550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.